The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show, the home of geek, folklore and paranormal entertainment, with me, Charles Christian, as once again we delve into the worlds of weirdness, urban myths, history, geek culture, ghosts, magic, witchcraft, the occult, and anything else I think will intrigue you. This week we are all over the place with a mixture of stories, including a mini Holidays from Hell feature, as we list a number of locations around England where you can still see the site of a hangman's gibbet, or at least a replica of the gibbet. But first, we have some news from Russia, where they have been investigating accounts of encounters with aliens and UFOs, or AUEs, as these events are now called. That's alien UFO encounters. Anyway, a total of 152 people took place in a study conducted by the Russian-based Phase Research Center, and of this sample, 114 people claimed to have had encounters with either aliens and or UFOs. But here's the intriguing bit. All 114 who had AUEs did so on an occasion where they were experiencing lucid dreams. Now, a lucid dream is a type of dream where the dreamer becomes aware they are dreaming. During a lucid dream, the dreamer may gain some amount of control over the dream characters, narrative, and environment. This is distinct from the normal type of dreams, which often feature paradoxical or illogical incidents. It is incidentally reckoned that 23% of people experience lucid dreams on a regular basis, as often as once a month. Now, obviously, the Russian research is academic in the sense that all 152 participants were instructed to find or summon aliens or UFOs during their dreams and to memorize the events. But it does raise the possibility that many of the reports of alien abductions we hear are actually the result of people experiencing lucid dreams that appeared at the time so real they truly believed they took place. As this is a family show, we'd best not speculate about people experiencing sexual encounters of the third kind with aliens. Now on with the show. Time now for the first of our gruesome gibbet guide tales. But let's start with a definition. Yes, a gibbet can mean a gallows or hanging tree, a location where a person is executed by being hanged. But we also have the phrase to gibbet, meaning the practice of suspending the bodies of executed criminals in chains or in a cage, usually at the scene of their crimes or a nearby crossroads, to serve as a warning to passers-by that this was a fate awaiting all criminals. Gibbeting began to be widely used in England in the 16th century and was not abolished until 1834. In fact, as recently as the Murder Act of 1751, it was stipulated that in no case whatsoever shall the body of a murderer be suffered to be buried, but should instead be dissected or hung in chains. The idea being that you continue the punishment for the crime long after the criminal's death. It also needs to remember that back then in those days, many people still believed any chance of their resurrection and afterlife, if you like, the destiny of the soul, was linked to the fate of the body. So if your body was destroyed, you wouldn't be able to go to heaven. Incidentally, women were never gibbeted, just men. It was thought indecent to gibbet a woman, so instead their bodies were left to medical students to dissect. So a lot nicer. Gibbeted corpses would sometimes be coated in tar to ensure they lasted a little longer before rotting away, but it's worth noting that sometimes rotting corpses would dangle from gibbets for years, a banquet for maggots and crows, wafting their stomach-churning scent as the chain creaked in the breeze. And not surprisingly, there were frequent complaints about the sight and smell of a decaying corpse, and attempts were made to remove and bury bodies. This is one reason why gibbet posts were so high, so as to make it difficult for anybody to rescue the body. There was also an interesting, albeit gruesome, folklore associated with gibbets. It was said that you could cure toothache by cutting a splinter off a gibbet, and indeed it's been reported that some of the replica gibbets that dotted around the country, people are still cutting off splinters. You cut off the splinter of the gibbet and you rub it on the offending tooth or gum. Objects associated with hangings were also believed to have magical or healing properties. Pieces of a hangman's cloth or skin were prized as talisman. Burglars believed the preserved hand of an executed felon, known as a hand of glory, and it was normally you tried to get the hand that did the dirty deed. So if you had a left-handed murderer, you wanted the left hand. It was believed that the hand of glory could be turned into a kind of magical candle that would cause anybody in its presence, other than the person holding it, to fall asleep, so ideal for burglars. And finally, bones that fell from the corpses as they turned into skeletons were prized possessions and used as cures for rheumatism. As I said, a very grim and gory area of English history. Anyway, let's start with the first of our gibbets, and the location is Steng Cross Gibbet in Northumberland. It's also known as Winter's Gibbet, and it's close to Scotland and was intended as a warning to cattle rustlers and border raiders that this is where they would end up. It's on a bleak moorland next to the B6342, about 8 miles east of Otterburn. And it's a replica gibbet, although it's a particularly gory one, as there appears to be a head attached to it. More about that later. Anyway, it was used to suspend the corpse of William Winter, who was a wanderer and highwayman, who raided a cottage in 1791, urged on by two sisters, who were his co-partners in the crime. Anyway, Winter knocked on the door and begged the cottage's sole occupant, an elderly woman, for shelter. The lady took pity and welcomed him in, whereupon he beat her, kicked her, slit her throat, and escaped with all her possessions loaded on a donkey. Winter and his two accomplices felt, given such a lonely spot, it would take a while for the victim to be discovered, giving them plenty of time to get away. But the gang were seen by a local shepherd boy who recognised the knife Winter was using to peel an apple that had once belonged to the old woman. And the boy, who appears to have been a premature juvenile Sherlock Holmes, also noted the pattern on the soles of Winter's boots, enabling the authorities to track the robber via his footprints in the mud. The three were arrested, tried in Newcastle, and condemned to death by hanging. The two sisters were executed and given up for dissection, and Winter's body was hung in chains from the gibbet. It's a prominent place, and I say, being on a roadside, it was away from houses, so the smell wouldn't be quite so bad. But, as I said, there's a head attached to it. the actual body rotted away a long time ago, although it's said Winter's ghost is rumoured to haunt the surrounding moorlands. And he causes sudden thick fogs at a nearby cattle grid. There is a head suspended from the cross. It's a concrete one. And there once was a whole concrete body, but people kept using it for shooting practice or stealing it. And the body was removed and now there's just a head. But it adds to the macabre nature because it's on a chain, so it creaks and groans, rather than the way that a gibbeted body would. Next stop, a bit further south, it's the Busby Stoop Inn in North Yorkshire. It's at the Sandhutton Crossroads near Thirsk. And there's the pub, and hanging by the front entrance to the pub is a gallows with a noose hanging from it. And until recently, the pub sign featured a spindleback chair. More of that later. Now, the story connected with this is that the landlord, a Thomas Busby, was a notorious drunkard and criminal. And one day in 1702, he quarrelled with his father-in-law. One suggestion is the old man was trying to rescue his daughter from Busby. The other was that they were both in a coin counterfeiting gang and they were arguing about the loot. Anyway, Busby lost his temper and beat his father-in-law to death. He was sentenced to be hung on the other side of the crossroads from his inn, after which his body was to be gibbeted. Before his execution, Busby was permitted to have one last drink in his own pub, so he sat in his favourite chair, this is the spindleback chair, and when he got up to face the rope, he is said to have cursed the seat, warning that anyone who sat in it would meet a premature and violent death. Anyway, exit Busby, to be hanged and left in chains to rot outside the pub, and back to the pub and the chair. And over the years, a number of people have been unwise enough to sit in Busby's chair, and all apparently have succumbed to his curse. A young labourer tricked by his colleagues to sitting on the seat the same day fell through the roof of the house he was working and killed. And in the Second World War, some Canadian airmen stationed near the Busby Stoop Inn dared each other to sit on the chair. Shortly afterwards, their plane crashed, killing everyone on board. One of the pub's landlords, disturbed by such stories, and bearing in mind this has now been going for 250 years, seems a little bit slow on the uptake, he hid the chair in the cellar. But one day a man delivering beer spotted the seat and decided to take a rest. A few hours later, his lorry crashed, killing him. The chair is now kept in a museum in the nearby town of Thirsk, hung high on a wall so no one is tempted to test whether the curse is true. Although it has to be said, some people dispute the chair's originality, claiming its style with machine-turned spindles would date it to after Busby's lifetime.
So, exciting times, eh? We are very, very excited here. Anyway, your new book is just out. And the feedback is really good, which I'm not too surprised about because it's excellent. However, it's called Shuckland. And its subtitle, just to give you a drift, is Weird Tales, Ghosts, Folklore and Legends from East Anglia's Waveney Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you tell us a bit more about it, elaborate on that subtitle, and maybe just go into your inspiration for writing it?
Right. Well, thank you, Janie. It's nice to have you back on the show.
Been a while. I love to be on the show, as you know, but sometimes schedules don't quite sync.
Yes. Anyway, the book.
Yes,
as you say,
book.
It's called Shuckland, and it takes its name from the notorious Black Shuck, which is a legendary creature, a hellhound that haunts this part of the world. hence the name Shuckland. And I suppose the inspiration is this is the part of the world we now live in, and travelling around it, just spotting odd plaques on buildings and reading snippets in magazines, etc., made me aware of the huge wealth of folklore and legend and everything surrounding it. And as is often the way, the more you dig into something, yet more and more stuff you find to follow up. And it was intriguing me, the fact that down the river valley, we've got this huge mixture. Old traditions, ghosts of avenging kings, highwaymen, headless queens, buried treasure, demonic entities, notorious villains, treacherous barons and murderous earls, paganism, witchcraft, and, of course, Black Shuck. And so I framed the book as a guidebook, and it takes you down the river from where it rises in Redgrave all the way down to the sea. And I suppose what really also I found fascinating is the way the Waveney Valley's vibe echoes the current enthusiasm for earth mysteries, or what sometimes people called psychogeography, and gothic tourism and folk horror. The fact that there's lots of weird stuff out in the wilds of the countryside.
Because the countryside around here, of course, has been inhabited for a very long time. It's an ancient land as well, isn't it? So there's many, many... its history is many thousands years old, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we touch upon it in the book that on the coastline, at the end of the Waveney Valley, footprints have been found of hominids. That's early man, not Homo sapiens, mm-hmm. but another species, going back 800,000 years.
Good grief. Yeah.
It's a huge amount of time.
Mm.
And obviously more recently, after the Ice Ages, this part of the world was where the land bridge, the land link to Europe was. Mm. And so as the ice receded and the last ice age, the southernmost lip of the ice sheet was about 50 miles north of here. As it receded, so the people came over the land bridge and repopulated the British Isles.
Right, right. So, because what obviously I notice in here is that awful lot of true life historical characters spanning centuries.
It's
a rich source of stories, ancient and indeed modern.
Yeah.
And again, with that strange thing that truth is often more strange than fiction.
Yes.
All of the characters and the stories that you tell, they have their roots in truth or are actually true. It's not just old buildings, flickering ghosts and historical dates.
Yeah.
You know, you've obviously made a point of finding the stories about the people, and that makes it interesting. Is that kind of what interests you, the fact that it's true?
Yeah.
Well,
I've always been a believer that no matter how fanciful the story, the legend is, if you scratch beneath the surface, eventually you'll come to some element of truth, some point of origin, which admittedly over the centuries has got distorted and changed. But it all has that element of truth lurking there. And I think one of the problems people get with history is that it does seem to be just dates and buildings and so on, but it's the people. It's the people and the significance of them. And it's the people that make the story. And sometimes they are historical people doing brave deeds. Other times they are just curious characters doing slightly offbeat things. But it all adds up to the to give the impression and the rich mix for the area.
Yeah, which, because it's ancient lands and somewhat out on a limb from the rest of the British Isles or England, you know, it's got this strange bulge and we're out here, it does have some very mysterious stories and legends, say, which you have obviously looked at and seem to be almost able to scrape back the layers of some of these folklores and legends and see why they came about and help us understand why, for instance, like Shuck might have been seemed to be true to people of the time, because obviously we don't have the benefit of our scientific knowledge, etc., etc. And that's what I found most interesting and fascinating. I was just to ask you about another bit that interests me particularly, because I don't understand it. The St. Mary and St. Michael ley line. Now, that features in this book. And, in fact, you made a comment. You say you use it as a framing device. But what I have to ask, what many may ask, are ley lines a real thing?
It's a good question, because there are plenty of believers that they are energy lines, or dragon lines, as they're called in China, and that they have a magical significance. However, there's another version that says, really, they're the old straight tracks that people used to follow back in the days before we had formal roads, and certainly before we had maps and signposts, and the quickest way to get from one place to another is in a straight line. And the quickest way to help navigate is to go from significant point to significant point. So if you're on a hill, you aim for the next hilltop and walk in a straight line that way. And then over the centuries, because so many people have been using those lines, those straight tracks, buildings have grown up there, churches have been built there, settlements have developed. So there is an element of, you know, is it chicken and egg? Is there a ley line there because lots of people were walking it, or were people walking it because there was a ley line there? But as I say, I use it as a framing device.
Yeah, yeah.
The St. Michael, St. Mary is probably the most famous ley line in the British Isles. And it runs from the Norfolk coast, which may seem a bit odd, except if you go back to ancient history, it was actually the entrance into the British Isles via the old land bridge across what we now call the North Sea. And it went down to the southwest, Cornwall. And again, that might be a bit of a scratching of the head, but Cornwall was the source of tin. And tin was the a major metal back in the Bronze Age, because you mixed tin with copper to get bronze. So it was, you know, just as people today fight for various types of soils and minerals that can be used in batteries for cell phones and things like that. This was the miracle ingredient of the Mesolithic era. And what's the easiest way to get there? Well, follow the straight line across the country, and in due course you pass all the significant places in history, Avebury, Stonehenge and the like, and you head on down to the west, and lo and behold, there is the land of tin. And I say, not just for English travellers, but for anybody else landing in the country and visiting. That was where the wealth was. That was what people were wanting. And so then they would return and they would have this magical material with them. And, you know, so it helped build up the legend that there was something significant about it.
I gotcha. All right.
Yeah.
I'm not a great history book lover, I have to say. I've sort of not got much attention span these days. But I do find, I did find that the way it was finally put together, it's very accessible, but at the same time has a lot of information there that will satisfy somebody who is really into history. But I think perhaps because it's broken up with quite a few diagrams and pictures and little odd notes and things, makes it not a dense read.
Yes.
Was that a particular plan that you had to kind of get this combination of accessibility and a bit of a lead-in for people that weren't that interested in history but still put the content in there?
Definitely. I mean, it's very much aimed as a popular book. It's not intended as an academic book. And I didn't want to present people with a huge mass of text that was just going to be heavy-duty wading your way through. So I've broken it up into smaller incidents, smaller sections, to make it bite-sized and the sort of book you can read snippets here and there. And as you say, we put in quite intriguing twos, which are really footnotes within the main narrative, just of, oh, by the way, did you know that? That doesn't quite fit in it.
No, it
was very much my idea to make it accessible that way because...
It worked, I think. And other people have said that, you know, who perhaps aren't mad history buffs, that it's readable. So that's lovely. So where can people find this book? How could they get hold of a copy?
Right. Well, it is available on Amazon. It's available in bookshops. And I'd say it's available on Amazon in the UK as a paperback, price £12.95. And it's also available both in the UK and generally on Amazon as an ebook for £3.25. And the ebook is an exact replica of the print book, so you still get all the diagrams and the pictures and the illustrations within the text rather than clumped around.
Yes, that awful thing where sometimes you have to wait to the end of the chapter or there's a footnote and you have to lose your place. That does not happen.
Yeah.
It's all in the same. That's really good. I like that.
Yep, and it's out and available now.
Fantastic. And it's, I should say, it's called Shuckland, S-H-U-C-K-L-A-N-D, as Black Shuck is the inspiration. Probably still roaming the land somewhere. And by Charles Christian. And yeah, that's lovely. Thank you very much for...
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
Now, Harrison Ford is currently in the UK filming the fifth of the Indiana Jones movies. He might want to head off to Burton-on-Trent, which is a brewery town in the Midlands, and to visit Sinai House, as it's suggested that beneath Sinai House, which is a 16th century timber-framed house, although part of it is now fairly derelict and being restored. Beneath it are a warren of tunnels, which are said to have been a home for storing treasure of the Knights Templars, including the Holy Grail and the Ark of the Covenant. Yes, buried in a brewery town. The theory stems from the fact that the land was taken over by the time of the dissolution of the monasteries by an ancestor of one of the Knights Templars. And the question is, why was he so keen to get his hands on the property? There was a monastery there, which was then demolished. And the theory is it was demolished because they were searching for something, the Templar treasure. Anyway, if we get any more updates on this, you'll be the first to know. Ever heard of Graham Island or Ferdinandia Island in the Mediterranean? Thinking about it for a possible holiday getaway? Listen and I'll tell you more about it, because this is the 190th anniversary of its most recent appearance. Now, in folklore, there are lots of tales of mysterious islands that come and go. Sometimes you hear of a hapless boat crew landing on an island only to discover that it's actually the back of some giant sea creature, such as a turtle or a whale, which then submerges and they all drown, very sadly. Other times it's an island that is glimpsed but you can never reach. Good example is High Brazil, which is not off Brazil, but is actually off the west coast of Ireland and crops up on a few medieval maps as a real place. And finally, of course, there's the granddaddy of them all, Atlantis. Did it really exist? Did it sink beneath the waves? Whatever. Anyway, let's talk about Graham Island. Possibly a more accurate name is the Graham Bank or Graham Shoal. And it is just off the end of Sicily, and it's a volcanic island that, as a result of volcanic action, periodically appears above the sea level, only for the volcano to cease being active, whereupon the sea washes away the stone that's been thrown out by the volcano, and it vanishes until it pops up again. And it is reported to have appeared and disappeared at least four times in historical accounts, the most recent one being almost exactly 190 years ago in July 1831. There were reports of high seismic activity and eruptions sometime around about the period 28th of June to 10th of July that year. And then there was accounts of smell of sulphur spreading across Sicily and a column of smoke being seen. And it was thought maybe it was a boat on fire. And somebody else reported that the sea was bubbling, and another said that there were lots of dead fish floating around it. Anyway, by the 17th of July, a fully grown islet had been formed, enough to where a Sicilian customs official called Michel Fiorini was able to land and claim the island for the Kingdom of Sicily. It should be noted that this was before Italy was formed as a country, and the southern part of the Italian peninsula was the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, which was southern Italy and the island of Sicily. Not to be outdone by the Sicilians, on the 2nd of August 1831, a Humphrey Fleming Stenhouse, the captain of a Royal Navy ship, HMS St. Vincent, claimed the island for the British Empire and named it after Sir James Graham, who was the first Lord of the Admiralty at the time. Which does sound a bit sucky-uppy, isn't it, naming an island after your boss? The eruptions of 1831 resulted in the island increasing in size. However, it was composed of a loose stone called tephra, which is basically volcanic ash, and was easily eroded by wave action. And when the eruptive episode ended, it rapidly subsided and disappeared beneath the waves in January 1832, so it was there for just less than 6 months. At its maximum in August 1831, it was 3 miles in circumference and 200 feet high, and also had two small lakes on it, so not an inconsiderable island. Curiously, because of its location, it was to the west of Sicily, heading towards the Tunisian coast. A dispute arose over its sovereignty. The United Kingdom claimed it as Graham Island. The king of the two Sicilies, Ferdinand II, after it was named Ferdinandia, also claimed it, as did the French Navy, who landed there, and they called the island Julia, because it was in July. And maybe also a reference to the fact that the French monarchy of the time was known as the July monarchy. And the Spanish, just for good measure, also claimed it. The reason why it was significant is that it was closer to Europe than Malta, and its location would have been of strategic importance. And so all the four nations in the Mediterranean wanted to get their hands on it. And there were various newspaper campaigns going, you know, don't let the foreigners get Graham Island from us. It's British. But, I say, sadly, before the negotiations could be resolved, or worse still, before we all went to war and had a fight over it, the island sank beneath the sea and there was no more trace of it. The Sicilians, incidentally, even reportedly thought about setting a holiday resort there on its beaches. Currently, in 2021, Graham Island remains about 26 feet below sea level. Of course, if it were to resurface this year, we'd still have to see whether it was declared a red list, amber or green list destination before we could travel there for our holidays. Incidentally, the saga of Graham Island has been the inspiration for a number of novels over the years, starting with James Fenimore Cooper's The Crater or Vulcan's Peak in 1847, and most recently, the late Sir Terry Pratchett's Discworld novel Jingo in 1997. So, not one for your holidays this year, but maybe one day. Our third gibbet is at Execution Dock at Wapping in East London. When the tide is low, go down the Pelican Stairs next to the Prospect of Whitby pub. And as you pick your way along the foreshore, which of course is fascinating because it's got pottery shards there, old clay pipes, all manner of stuff. Indeed, we will be having an interview with a well-known London mudlark, a person who goes exploring the beaches. You'll see a gibbet rising from the sand with a noose dangling from a surprisingly short rope. This is because you're near the site of Execution Dock, where for over four centuries, pirates, mutineers and smugglers were hanged. They were executed here because they'd been sentenced by Admiralty courts whose jurisdiction covered all crimes committed at sea. The gallows at Execution Dock were just below the low tide mark on the river. And, yes, crimes for which sailors could be hung included murder on the high seas, acts of mutiny that led to death, and sodomy. They were all brought back and taken to Execution Dock. And there is a bit of a debate about quite where it was located. But I say it is thought it was next to the Prospect of Whitby pub. And one of the most famous people or infamous people to be executed there was Captain Kidd. It was a particularly gruesome way of executing criminals because they were hanged on a short rope. So instead of it snapping their neck, they spent half an hour strangling to death and suffocating. And if this wasn't enough, they weren't cut down until at least three tides had washed over their heads, just to make sure. So drowned you as well as hang you. The last executions at Execution Dock were in 1830. Once they'd been executed, the remains were hung in chains either at Execution Dock or at Cuckold's Point on the Rotherhithe Peninsula or Blackwall Point near where the O2 Arena now stands. Time now for another creature feature courtesy of my column in the Ancient Origins magazine. And with the Olympic Games now taking place in Japan, this time around I'm focusing on the dragon, a fabulous beast that features heavily in Japanese folklore and legend. Let's start at the beginning. You find legends of dragons and dragon-like creatures in almost all cultures on the planet, but where did they originate? There are two popular suggestions, and the truth is probably a mixture of the two. The first is they stem from tales of encounters with real creatures, but became mangled and exaggerated with retelling, a bit like an angler's tale of how big were the fish they caught that they had to throw back. So imagine you are in the city of Constantinople in the year 800 AD, and a traveller is telling you the tale of an encounter with a crocodile. Or you are in Kyoto, the former capital of Japan, that same year, listening to tales of the Komodo dragon, a real-life beast with a venomous bite. You'd be in little doubt that they were talking about dragons. Combine this with a second factor, the discovery of dinosaur bones, mammoth bones, and the partially decomposed remains of whales washing up the shore. And to this day, whale remains are still being misinterpreted as sea monsters. And once more, you would believe they were the remains of dragons. Given the global appeal of dragons, it's hardly surprising that different cultures have depicted them in different ways over the years. For example, the European version tends to be a flying, fire-breathing or venom-spewing dinosaur, whereas the Japanese dragon is more of a water deity, usually depicted as a large, wingless, serpentine creature with clawed feet. It's also generally reckoned the Japanese dragon was heavily influenced by the Chinese dragons and indeed contains features imported from Chinese, Korean and Indian dragon legends. But, talking of the Japanese dragons, there are differences. For example, the Japanese dragons are almost always shown with three claws in each foot, whereas in Korea it is four claws, and in China the imperial dragon has five claws. Word of advice, if you do encounter a dragon, probably best not to examine its feet to see how many claws it's got. Also, there are differences in behaviour. Chinese dragons are generally benevolent, bringing the rains, and are needed for agriculture, whereas Japanese dragons are more malevolent and prone, like their European counterparts, to snacking on innocent maidens. At least until some hero comes along to slay them. But to get back the question I posed at the outset, can you actually train a dragon? Fantasy novels and movies frequently feature reluctant heroes who discover they have magical powers and allow them to charm and subdue dragons. Folklore, however, tells a different story. In the best-known example, the golden legend telling of St. George and the Dragon, St. George arrives to save a virgin princess who has been offered as a sacrifice to the dragon. St. George wounds the dragon with his spear and then asks to borrow the princess's girdle. This, I should point out, is not a piece of underwear, but there was the name for the belt worn outside a dress in medieval times, which he then places around the dragon's neck. And the dragon then follows the princess like a beak beast, or the tamest dog, depending on the translation, on a leash. Problem solved. If you plan to go dragon hunting this summer, ensure you are accompanied by a belt-wearing virgin maiden. Our next gruesome gibbet holiday destination is Caxton Gibbet in Cambridgeshire, which stands on the A1198, which used to be called the Ermine Street Road, which links London to Huntingdon, close to the crossroad connecting the Cambridge and St. Neots. The rumour, this Caxton gibbet, it has to be said, is a replica. The original gibbet rotted away sometime during the early part of the 19th century when gibbeting ceased to be lawful and public executions ceased to be practice. But the replica was set up in the early 1900s as a mock gallows. Possibly it was to drum up business for a nearby pub called the Caxton Gibbet. Nowadays it's near a number of motorway services and actually stands in the car park of a McDonald's. I know nobody's thought of the novelty of maybe having a Ronald McDonald swinging from the gibbet. There was a particularly gruesome story associated with it that people were left in chains while they were still alive. And one tales of a murderer called Partridge who was hanging there still alive, and a baker went past and feeling sorry for him, the baker threw him some pieces of bread. And for his crime, the baker was arrested and also hung alive from a gibbet, which is a, you know, very gory story, except, of course, it didn't happen. Convicts were gibbeted at Caxton from the 1670s, and it was still in use in 1745, but nobody was actually still there hanged in while they were still alive. They were always dead. And now for another of our gruesome gibbet tales. And this is Coombe Gibbet in Berkshire. And it stands on Gallows Down. No guessing where the name comes from. And it's actually on top of a long barrow. So going back even further into ancient history. And it was erected in 1676 to display the bodies of George Brougham and Dorothy Newman. And as far as we know, it was only used for them. These two were having an affair and they murdered Broom's wife, Martha, and son, Robert, who, when they were stumbled upon the lovers in the down. Despite its sinister past, the gibbet now seems to be the centre of fun activities and is often surrounded by hang gliders and paragliders, and is the start of an off-road run called the Coombe Gibbet Race, which takes place every year. And the current gibbet is another replica. For the final of our gibbet tales, we have the story of the unknown sailor, an anonymous seafarer, murdered in September 1786 at Hindhead in Surrey. And his murderers were hanged in chains on, appropriately named, Gibbet Hill the following year. The saga is that the sailor had been drinking in the Red Lion pub at the nearby village of Thursley as he was walking back from London to rejoin his ship in Portsmouth in late September. And say he's unknown, but some people have suggested that he might actually be called Edward Hardman, who was born in Lambeth in 1752. But say that's merely supposition. Anyway, the sailor was drinking in the pub and he met three other seafarers there, a James Marshall, a Michael Casey and an Edward Longeon. And he paid for their drinks and food and was last seen leaving for Hindhead Hill with them. Clearly, he thought they were friends and they were all going to make their way down the London Road to Portsmouth. Unfortunately, they weren't his friends because they murdered him and stripped him of his clothes. They then headed down but were arrested a few hours later trying to sell the murdered sailor's clothes at the Sun Inn, not in the village of Rake. The Hampshire Chronicle of the 2nd of October 1786 reads, Sunday last, a shocking murder was committed by three sailors and one of their companions, a seaman also, between Godalming. They nearly severed his head from his body, stripped him quite naked, and threw him into a valley, where he was providentially discovered soon after the perpetration of the horrid crime by some countrymen corning over Hindhead, who immediately gave alarm. When the desperadoes were instantly pursued and overtaken at the house of Mr. Adams at the Sun Inn at Rake, they were properly secured and since lodged in jail to take their trial at the next assizes in the county of Surrey. 6 months later, they were tried at Kingston Assizes, and 2 days after that, they were executed and their bodies hanged in chains on a special triple gibbet that had been built close to the scene of their crime at Hindhead. And apparently the locals were very proud that they were able to build a gibbet that would hold three bodies. Now, the gibbet has long since gone. However, there are three memorials. In Thursley Churchyard, there is a gravestone paid for by the residents that reads, "In memory of a generous but unfortunate sailor who was barbarously murdered on Hindhead by three villains." Then, on the Old London Road, now you need to watch out if you're driving because there's now a tunnel that goes under this whole area. Devil's Punch Bowl, as it's called. So you need to get off the main London to Portsmouth Road to find this. But it's called the Sailor's Stone, and it was erected by a local man. And it says on the front, "Erected in detestation of a barbarous murder committed here on an unknown sailor." And ends with the biblical term, phrase, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood by man shall his blood be shed." That stone was erected in 1786 and then renovated in 1889 by one of his descendants. And on the back of the inscription, back of the stone, there is another inscription, and it says, "Cursed be the man who injureth or removeth this stone." This possibly explains why the stone was first moved in 1826 when the London Road was realigned, and then it was replaced a bit later at another corner and then moved back to its original location with the curse being added on the back when the road was changed again. And then finally it was moved again in 1832 back to where it is now, which is believed to be where it originally was. But the road's been moved and changed around. And finally, we have a Celtic cross, which was paid for by a local squire. It was on the site on Gibbet Hill of the actual gibbet. Was erected by Sir William Early, and he did this to dispel the fear and superstitions of local people and to raise their spirits. Latin inscription on it which says, translation, "Light after darkness, peace in passing away, hope in light, salvation after death." This is because the area had a reputation for being haunted by the ghosts of the murder victim and also the three murderers. And it was thought that putting a nice Christian cross there in place of the original gibbet would raise people's spirits and generally improve the area. So there you have it. Lots of gibbets to visit if you are travelling around England.
England, home to zombies, werewolves, green-skinned fairy folk? And how about dragons, strange monoliths and vampires? If you're fascinated by the bizarre and unexplained, join Charles on a road trip around the newly discovered Wald-Newton Triangle, where fact is much weirder than any fiction. Check out Charles Christian's fantastic Kindle book, A Travel Guide to Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, on amazon.co.uk and amazon.com.
And And that's almost it. Just time for one last story, and it's another gruesome location for a holiday jaunt. This time to Bears Creek, North Carolina, courtesy of the Atlas Obscura website, to visit the Devil's Tramping Ground. Now, the Devil's Tramping Ground at Bear Creek is just off State Route 902 and is about 50 miles south of Greensboro. And unlike some urban legends, the tradition surrounding the Devil's Tramping Ground goes back 140 years to 1882. The tramping ground is an empty patch in the middle of some woods. It just looks like a dusty circle, barren of plant life, about 15 feet wide, where, according to stories going back, as I mentioned, to the late 19th century, the devil comes out to dance. The stories go on to say that nothing will grow there and animals won't cross this empty patch of woodland. The most popular legend about the patch is that if you place anything in the centre, no matter how heavy it is, when you come back the next day, it's been thrown back out overnight. So, the saying goes, the devil has room to dance. Yeah, they don't want that old piano standing in the middle of the dancing area. And people say they have witnessed red glowing eyes in the middle of the circle. A few years ago, a journalist from the Greensboro newspaper did actually spend a night in a tent right in the middle of it with his two dogs to disprove the story. He did stay the entire night, though he reported hearing footsteps circling his tent. All of which leaves you wondering whether the circle represents the territory of some nocturnal animal, or perhaps the duty of spooking folks has been passed down from generation to generation by the locals. Oh, look, there's somebody else camping there. Let's go and scare them in the night. Or possibly the camping grounds are simply so imbued with legend that stories simply seem to come true in the minds of viewers. Atlas Obscura warned that you should also keep an eye out for beer cans, as this spot is a favourite of both the devil and local teenagers. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian Thames. Thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more strange tales for strange times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.